call you if anybody wants it, and we have a debate going on about whether to continue doing CDs or just through MP3s. So any feedback about that would be great. I mean, if people still want CDs, then we can still keep doing them. But if actually people are happy with MP3s or computer recordings, online recordings, web recordings, that'd be great. It'd be easier for us to do. But Ian is a psychotherapist at Glastonbury, and we're very excited to have him today.
Thank you.
And he'll be talking for about an hour. We'll have coffee for half an hour and then discussion for 2 minutes an hour.
Thank you. The title of this lecture is about taken from an old Egyptian poem. Can you all hear me in the back? Yep, good. About the dialogue of a man with his bar soul. But I guess the other point of this lecture, the other purpose of that the poem in fact helps us with, perhaps, is the idea of soul making in hard times, in difficult times. Last time I was here was 4 days after Donald Trump won the American election. Vividly etched in my mind. And the time since then, I'm almost frightened to turn on my TV most days, because every day something mad, difficult, almost unbelievable seems to happen. It's not environmental, it's political, it's the rise of fascism all over the world. The sense of a world breaking apart. In a way that's sort of unbelievable, breaking apart with a speed and in such a way that you think, well, what's going on here? What is happening? How can we live in times when everything feels like it's falling apart? It's not helped in my case by the fact that I'm older and my body is rapidly decaying, and so if I move around quite a lot, it's because I've got a rather dodgy knee, so sort of, which if I stay still too much, locks in place, and sort of then I'd have to hop to a chair or something. But to come back to this question, how can we live in times when everything is falling apart? How can we live in times when everything is polarizing? I'm a child of the 1950s, really, and sort of, I remember vividly how grim the 1950s in South Wales were. They may not have been grim in other places, but in South Wales it was grim but stable. And then the 60s and the 70s came along, which were these kind of explosions of possibilities. And the world felt like it was opening up into some new extraordinary kind of place. Until Margaret Thatcher came along and Reagan came along. And it's almost just from who I am and my own political persuasion, my own attitude to life. I feel sometimes like I've been sort of fighting a rearguard action for the last 40 years, and it's not going very well. So when I was thinking about the subject for this talk and kind of looking at they're thinking about, well, okay, how can we live? Given that we are living here, and hopefully, well, I haven't got a hope, actually, just at the moment. Hope is not where I am. It's more about how do we live with difficult times, polarized times. And in a sense, it kind of took me to the idea of the soul. And I'm going to just read you just an extract from the Red Book. This is one of the places this is not quite my sacred scripture, but it's one of the places I go to and sort of when I'm at my wit's end and I think maybe there'll be something helpful in here. And actually there was. It's It's right at the beginning of the Red Book, where Jung talks about the conflict between the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. And of course, obviously, he's talking about it in his time. And in a sense, from where we are now, it seems to me we are much more polarized than we ever were at his time. But the same principle applies. What happens when you consider the spirit of the times in relation to the spirit of the depths? Now, this is the spirit of the depths. This has got particular purpose, I think, at the moment, because the spirit of the times could not be more uninsouled, could not be more superficial, could not be more surface. I mean, God knows it was bad enough when you had a sort of a Reagan as a movie star becoming the most powerful man in the world. Now we have a reality show host as the most powerful man in the world, spun out even further, in my opinion, than Reagan. Somebody, a president worse than Reagan. Who saw that coming? Now, but this dialogue that Jung talks about right at the beginning of the Red Book is, in a way, indicates a directionality. What do we do when we are out of tune with the times? In fact, even more so, where the spirit of the times feels poisonous, impossible to live with. Well, in a sense, what Jung would say, I guess, and I suppose what I'm saying, is then we have no alternative other than to address the depth. The other thing we can do, of course, is to collaborate with the spirit of the times, to ourselves become uninsouled, I suppose, to market ourselves, to brand ourselves. There's this astonishing thing, I think, that happens these days, where people are their own brands. The whole world of social media is kind of fascinating. I have this horrid fascination with it in some ways, where you see people now, instead of living their lives, living a facsimile of their own lives. And it's sort of compelling. I get it. I understand the compelling nature of it. It's exciting. It's trying to live in your own world of advertising in a certain sense, where everything is kind of clear-cut, shiny. Everything is good. There is no mess, or there is no decay. Well, there is, of course, but it's never presented. You know, we hear a lot of things about young people and the pressures on young people through social media. I'm not saying social media is bad. There are good aspects of social media, but I think it's one of the signs of the time that we live in, where we're living in a very narrow aspect band of the human experience. Now, so what Jung would say to us is to really start to address the depth, address, in that sense, to address the idea of the soul. Now, what he says about this is that he whose desire turns away from outer things reaches the place of the soul. If he does not find the soul, the horror of emptiness will overcome him. And fear will drive him with a whip-lashing time, and again in a desperate endeavor and a blind desire for the hollow things of the world. He becomes a fool through his endless desire and forgets the way of his soul, never to find her again. He will run after all things and will seize hold of them, but he will not find his soul, since he would find her only in himself. Truly his soul lies in things and men, but the blind one seizes things and men, yet not his soul in things and men. He has no knowledge of his soul. How could he tell her apart from things and men? He could find his soul in desire itself, but not in the objects of desire. If he possessed his desire, and his desire did not possess him, he would lay a hand upon his soul, since his desire is the image and the expression of his soul. The wealth of the soul exists as images. Now, what he's talking about there is a turning inward. a turning inward, and instead of moving outwards, constantly moving outwards in order to fill a hollow space, a terrifying space with things that once you have them become hollow again. And the psychology of desire is interesting. When I want something, it's at its most satisfying in the moment when I'm buying it. Once I've bought it, it's just mine. It loses its hypnotic, tantalizing energy. And of course, the dynamic really of the whole world at the moment is about becoming something. Even the self itself, the persona itself, is to become a thing, to become a popular person, to become a strong person, to become a successful person. The objectification of the soul itself as an object among other objects. Now the movement really that is needed and that Jung's talking about is a 90 degree turn where we look inwards, where we look into the nature of desire, the nature of fear, the nature of that of loss and rage and all the other energies that are emerging from the depths. And that has always been true, really. I mean, that's always the path. It's the inner path of spirituality. It's the path of psychotherapy. It's the movement away from the projected world into meeting the energies of life in the depths of yourself. And one of the key things in that description is the art of the image. The wealth of the soul is in the image. Now the image is an interesting thing, really, because images can be either idols or icons, I think. As idols, they are oppressive forms that we have to, like an idol, that we have to serve. They block the light. In fact, you live in the shadow of the idol, serving the idol, which could be the image of myself as a charismatic and wonderful speaker who everybody loves. Can't imagine where I got that example from. Now, if I just to take me as this current example, if I in this moment try to be that, try to serve that, I lose my connection with you and with the depths that I'm trying to listen to in order for this talk to happen. I become self-referential, locked in a sort of loop really of my own, fascinated by my own charismatic brilliance. And as such, eventually, I might persuade one or two of you that is true, and we could enter into a folie à deux together, perhaps. But mostly that wouldn't work. But the attempt to keep that image working and to keep that loop turning is one of the great engines of the world at the moment. Now, the other aspect of image is image as icon. Now that image as a transitional phenomena that actually takes you beyond the image into something kind of more mysterious. And as we know, a lot of Jung's work has been in his work both in dreams, his work on active imagination, his work on alchemy and mythology, has been about exploring the iconic aspect of image, the iconic aspect of the soul. Now, this is an entirely different way. This is, and again, it follows on from this the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. To counter the image as icon, I have to turn inwards and let and allow the image to impact me and allow it to take me into the depths. In a certain sense, I have to, something in me has to die, something has to surrender into the mystery of the living image. Now, periodically in human history, you have the images are interesting. Right at the moment, we have this extraordinary secular civilization that's driven by advertising, driven by the desire to convince us that there is a hole in the human heart that can be filled by buying something. This is the great corporations of the world, in a way, rely upon this dynamic. And if something goes wrong in that dynamic, when we see things like the financial crash of 2008, when the buying the perfect home kind of fantasies that went wrong, the whole of the world's economic system started to fall apart. But it's a compelling energy, and actually, in order to not be caught in that, not be hypnotized in that, we need help, I think. And it's one of the reasons, I think, why Jung, in his later work, having done lots of work on himself in his own process with his own clients, starts to look at the collective experience, starts to look at where at other times have people studied the soul, studied the image, found other ways of doing things. I mean, the thing that Jung is addressing, and which is still our issue, is the problem of Faustian man. Now, he, as you may know, one of his great inner figures was a figure called Philemon, who he'd experienced as an old man with the wings of a kingfisher, who taught him, he said, the objectivity of the subject, of the subjective, who taught him the objectivity of the soul and the nature of the soul. Now, Philemon is a figure that we first find in Ovid's Metamorphoses, and then later in Goethe's Faust. And Philemon and his wife Baucis represent in Ovid are a man and a woman who, in a time when nobody is giving hospitality to the gods, gives hospitality to two hidden figures that turn out to be gods. And they are rewarded because they're Greek gods, so they've punished everybody else in the way the Greek gods want to do, and sort of killed everybody who didn't give them hospitality. But Philemon and Baucis were turned into the priest and priestess, and their little cottage turned into a temple. And in a sense, they represent that aspect of the human being that can give hospitality to the gods, which from another point of view, we could say, can allow the spirit of the depths and the images of the depths to live amongst us and to nourish us. In Goethe's Faust, the Faust, who in a sense, in a way, it really does represent the something of the quality of the modern human being, sells his soul to Mephistopheles in order to get the things that he desires. This is the thing that Jung is talking about. You lose your soul, you give it away, you barter it in exchange for things. And one of the things that happens is that Faust is building this wonderful palace, completely reordering the world around him. And in the background of his landscape garden is a rather rickety cottage where Philemon and Baucis are still living, because they have been made immortal by the gods. And it's spoiling his view. And so he asks Mephistopheles to do something about it. And Mephistopheles, being Mephistopheles, who is all about agency and doing the most sensible thing, decides that the most efficient, most sensible thing to do here is to wait till Philemon and Baucis are in bed and then burn the cottage down and kill them. No new cottage to build, no compensation, very efficient, very kind of rational. It's a chillingly accurate kind of description of a lot of modern statecraft. Let's do the easy, efficient, sensible thing. And let's not feel that we're actually in that process. We're burning an old couple whose only crime is that they happen to have spoiled somebody else's, a more powerful person's view. Okay. So somewhere, if we're going to kind of live in these times, and even to some extent hopefully thrive and survive in these times, We need to find our own way of connecting to the depth, our own way of not being overwhelmed, I suppose, by the experiences, the thrust of the world all around us. And a bit like Jung did, when I was thinking about this, I went looking. Well, okay, where are there other occasions when societies have been completely destroyed, and how do people recover? What happens? How does the soul of a culture almost find itself again? And one of the places I was drawn to was ancient Egypt. And I have to say, it's a bit cool giving a talk about ancient Egypt in a room where there's got a pyramid above us, which is rather nice. I'd forgotten this because it's been a long time since I've been here. And do you remember all this stuff in the sort of 70s about when people were putting razor blades in pyramids in order to sharpen them? Well, maybe this will sharpen my mind a little, so that will help the talk a bit. But partly I went to ancient Egypt because I got a kind of fascination with it. But in particular because the Egyptian civilization is very focused on image. The whole thrust of Egyptian religion really was about creating the ensouled image. In Egyptian tradition and temples, they're all basically based around the image of the god or the goddess that particularizes and universal principles. And the other thing I remembered is that the Egyptian society was this very, very stable society for about 5,000 years. But there was one very dramatic period when the society was completely disrupted because of the sort of messianic vision of one man. And this is the Pharaoh Akhenaton, who at the end of the middle period of Egyptian tradition had a vision that he needed to sweep away all the gods of Egypt and to create a new religion, which he called Atenism, which would be the worship of the sun god as a living disk, and that he and his family would be the avatars of. Now, there's a long tradition of pharaohs in Egypt being divine, but what he did something very particular in that he stripped away the whole kind of collective basis of the Egyptian cultural tradition, based it around himself and his family, and stripped all the strange images that you get in Egyptian tradition and replaced it by this image of the sun with lots of hands coming out in blessing. Now, superficially, that sounds very nice and sort of a very early Egyptological studies of Akhenaten thought, well, this is wonderful, this is the beginning of monotheism, this man is a sort of religious genius. But actually, what he did was to personalize the divine principles, to take away, if you like, the rich and mysterious soul life of Egypt, and build an image, rather like Faust, really. He built an image, literally built a city called Amarna, where that had no room for anybody else's vision other than his own. It was a totalitarian religious vision. And oddly, it's a vision of the surface. It's a vision of there's the god up there in the sky, here are we. And it's produced incredible artwork. I mean, I don't say Akhenaten is universally horrible, but it produced wonderful looking artwork. Artwork that we can identify with. Because there's lots of family figures in it, but the families are always Akhenaten's family. It's beautiful, and it's something that we can understand and that our conscious mind finds very pleasing. The thing that's very clear in it is that there is no depth. There's no sense of good. In the Egyptian temples, there's in the older temples, you go into darkness. You go from a big space into a small space. In Akhenaten's tradition, you go into a big open court, you stand there in the sun, you live upon the surface of the world. Now, the other thing that happens in Akhenaten's time is the whole thing goes to hell. He's obsessed with his vision. He's pursuing his particular cult of Akhenaten. You know, it's a very similar idea to the cult of personality, cult of creating the world in my image. That part in me, that part in the world where we create the world in our own image and will sacrifice anything to enable that to come about. You know, what happens in ancient Egypt, which had been this very stable society, there is famine, there's war, there's all kinds of things that happen. Rather topically, the city of Amman of itself isn't very well supplied with water, and eventually the whole enterprise falls apart. But what's interesting then is what happens next. And you see something emerging in Egypt that hadn't been there before. You find a whole selection of literature called the Books of the Netherworld, and then another set of literature that has dialogues about how the world has gone to hell and what do we do about it. So it's a sort of cataclysmic, how do we recover from cataclysm? How do we live in the midst of cataclysm? Now, the Books of the Netherworld are interesting because they are, in contrast to Akhenaten's vision of rising up, ascension images, and being in the light of the sun, they are images of descent into the depth. You go to in a way that most of them are inscribed, and many of the later tombs in the Valley of the Kings. If you've ever been to the Valley of Kings in Egypt, you find the Netherworld books inscribed upon the walls, and the thrust of them really is that you move from the surface world, you enter into a sort of a communion with the depths, and you encounter normally serpentine figures, ambivalent serpents that are both kind of exciting, ambivalent, powerful, and that have to be related to. And there's a very particular book called the Book of Gates, which we find in the tomb of Sethos I, Ramses VI, and there's a whole little period where this book becomes very important, and it's really as the kingdoms are emerging out of the Amarna crisis. And I won't go into the details, we have not the time, but the whole thrust of these books is the sense of descent into the other world, movement through encounters with energies that are both confusing and dangerous, but have a sort of numinous power, and that there is a constant need to create balance. Basically, it's a night journey. And they look at the 12 hours of the night, where you start off with the sun, with the aged sun, and so you start in a place where there isn't much life or energy. A place where there's not much hope either, in some senses. So a place where you feel tired, maybe fed up, can't keep on going. What to do? And these books that are funerary books were also used by Egyptians at this time, living Egyptians, to contemplate life. They used the images, they're packed full of images and ideas that really are about this sense of descending into the depths. Because I'm too tired, I'm fed up, I don't know what to do, the world has gone to pieces. And there's almost something about trusting that energy of depression, that energy of... not a comfortable message, really, there's a great image in the Book of Gates of Atum Re, the sun god, who's leaning on a stick, like he's had it, he's done the whole, hadn't done the whole thing, and he just he's sort of kind of limping, rather like me with my knee, limping around, and what happens is he has these, he has to, in a way, give himself, and the person who would be, if you like, the ancient Egyptian who would be visualizing, using active imagination to explore these texts, would be engaging with this sense of just falling down, falling into, but somewhere, but also being held by something, because which I guess we might call the soul, that eventually takes you to the deepest part of the underworld, where the sun god enters this place where there is a sense of judgment and decision. Now, in the more popularly known kind of Book of the Dead, there's a sort of great, there's a great kind of image of the gods weigh your soul and you're judged if you're worthy or not. In the Book of Gates, there's a very simple image of the image of the god who's also the human person pursuing this process, standing for the god Osiris, as a living pair of scales that are empty. So there is this place of descent, this place of meeting, if you like, the god of death. I mean, Osiris is both the god of death and the god of resurrection. He's the Baali god that's buried in the earth that then springs up again. So we're given this image of presenting ourselves before this mysterious energy that is about death but holds the possibility of new life. But we stand as a pair of empty scales, balanced and empty at the same time. And this is a great moment in this book, so of reversal, where you've gone, if you like, that depressing energy, that energy of collapse, has taken you to a place where you stand naked before the place of death. But there's a sort of, in that kind of emptiness, there's a sense of balance. There's a sense of not trying. I don't know if you're familiar with that place where you kind of just give up. Oh, okay. You're present, but you don't have any idea what to do next. And if you're familiar with that place, there's a kind of stillness in it, a sort of simplicity. Now, in the Book of Gates is then the beginning of a movement of ascent, where actually something else starts to move through you, the energy of the deeper soul in their way of thinking, the resurrecting energy of Osiris starts to work within you, starts to move you slowly through a process where you keep on having to find balance. And you keep on having to, one of the refrains in the Book of Gates is you keep pausing to take cool water. So there's a sort of a movement, as in the movement outwards, there's a movement of continually having to work with friction, having to come back to the place of being the empty scales, and having to take cool water to refresh yourself. And there's something about that place of cooling, which is, if you've ever been in the Egyptian sun, water cooling is very, very important. You get overheated there very quickly. But in a way, it's also referring to that overheated energy in ourselves, that kind of desire to kind of be loved, to be powerful, to do something or to stop something. There's a very powerful message in it about come back to the empty scales, cool the water, keep on moving. There's an image also used in the book of a spiral serpent where you keep on repeating things, but there's a gradual movement. So the actual movement through the Book of Gates, in a way, is the sense, the rather frustrating sense of repeating something, but inching forward slowly. So it invites us, these images in a sense invite us to, in a sense, to, in that place of, oh my God, what do I do? How can I live in this world? To trust that place to trust the place of stopping, to trust actually the place where we are, the wounded, the old sun god. that energy of awareness and consciousness and putting things out cannot do it. We have to turn inward, be in a different way. And then it's the powerful and difficult thing, really, is to keep trust this mysterious, repetitive process, which can sometimes feel like just going round and round the same circle. I mean, those who are therapists who have been in therapy will know that feeling of, I'm so stuck. Or sometimes they're so stuck, depending on whether it's you or somebody you're working with. But actually, there is always a mysterious dynamic, in my experience. Often invisible, often not very easily seen, that within the repetition that is gradually moving us into something new. And in a certain sense, often these movements have to be slow and repetitive in order for us not to be overwhelmed by the new. You know, one of the great, you know, problems, I think, of the apparent nature of modern life is the constant appearance of the new. You know, things become, you know, you just buy things. You think it's the really fatal thing to do, I think, is to find an object, a bit of clothing that you like, because you will never find it again, because it's constantly, part of this outer dynamic is constantly giving us novelty so that we are caught in the dynamic. There's something about this other way of moving, this, if you like, spiral and straight way of moving, where there's a sort of inching forward like a snail through the process of repetition. Now that's part, that's the experience of the depth. But of course, it's very difficult to do this. And another text I found I've just found help, because actually, how do you trust this process? Because in order to trust a process of going into the depths and following a process that actually feels sometimes that you're getting more depressed or more lost, or constantly up against a mystery, and you look up at the world and everybody seems so bloody clear and they know what they're doing and not only do they know what they're doing, they can sell it to you and you'll have a better life if you buy it. You know, so it's quite hard. It's actually much harder than in Jung's time, I think, to trust the work of the soul. Because the outer forces are so compelling, and a very normal and natural part of this process is the process of feeling disheartened, feeling lost. And I think what I found helpful, what was helpful to me about this Egyptian material is, you know, 4,000 years ago. And there's something about, okay, this is a bigger context. This is not the first time this has happened in human life. It's universal now because our technologies are much more powerful. But human beings find ways through things. And the other thing I found when was a poem. One of these rather extraordinary synchronous things. This poem, we only know about this poem because it was used as a text for scribes to practice scribe work. So there's only ever one copy of this left in the world, and it's called The Lamentations and the Dialogue of a Man and His Soul, and it's really about the whole nature of this poem. Is about, well, how can I live in these times? And in a way, the Book of Gates and the book of the other books of the Netherworld give us a powerful kind of pattern and powerful images that we can relate to if we take the images inwards. What they don't give us is the kind of the emotional content, the kind of sense of we don't know, you know, we know so little about these ancient societies. We don't know, well, what did people feel when they were doing this? And in a sense, this little poem, The Lamentations of the Man and His Soul, give us a sense of the emotional experience of going through something like this. Let's read some little selections of it, just to give you a flavor of it. Now, we haven't got it in its full form, it's fragmentary. And it starts off with the man talking to his soul and feeling abandoned. And it says this: I opened my mouth to my soul to answer what he'd said. And this is the man now talking to his soul. This is too much for me today. It's too much. My soul does not agree with me. I'm not exaggerating. My soul has departed from me and is ignoring my problem. My soul should stand up for me in this matter. But he cannot escape me because he is caught in the net of ropes of my body. He's very angry with his soul at this point. He will not escape on the day of suffering. My soul leads me astray, even though I do not listen to him. It's very good. Pulls me towards death, even though I've not yet come to it. Throws me on the fire to burn me up. What is his suffering that he should turn his back on my companionship? He should be near me on the day of suffering. He should stand on the other side like one who rejoices. This is how to proceed and help me to survive this safely. Because now he's thinking about dying. He's had enough. I don't want to live. I just want to die. My soul is foolish because it downplays the misery of life. But he drags me to death even though I haven't come to it. So there's a lot of kind of confusion here. I would like my soul to make the West pleasant for me. The West is the land of the dead. I would like my soul to make the West pleasant for me. Because life is a transitory state and trees fall. And then this is a very pious bit now where he's trying to argue his soul into letting him die. May Thoth, who appeases the gods, judge me not. May Khonsu, who writes the truth, defend me. May Ra, who steers the ship of the sun, hear my words. May the god of the scales defend me in the judgment hall. My need is heavy. My soul has placed such a heavy burden on me. It would be a sweet relief if the gods were to rid my body of all my difficulties. Now, you can hear this kind of cry here somewhere. You know, sort of had enough, and Egyptian images of the afterlife were of something that was peaceful, something that was beautiful. He's crying out about, I cannot stand the way the world has become. My burdens are too heavy, and even my soul will not talk to me. So his soul replies, are you not a man? So you're alive, but to what end are you alive? You should ponder life, ponder the possession of all your riches. He's not thrilled by this, as you wrote about it. So it's basically saying something that's very challenging to him. He's saying, my life is terrible. My life is really terrible. Everything's terrible. You should ponder life. Life is full of riches. It sounds like some horrible kind of positive thinking thing, doesn't it? Don't think about that. Think about this. Man replies, I've not passed on yet, but this is the point. You're the one, he's pointing the finger at the soul, you're the one pointing away to a place where I will not care for you. Every criminal will seize you. And where you die, your name will live on. Yonder is a place of alighting, of security for the mind. Now he's now going to start to cajole his soul. If my soul listens to me, without wrongdoing so, I will make him reach the West like somebody in a pyramid whose burial an heir has attended. I will make an awning for the corpse of my corpse that will make any other lost souls envious. I will make an awning that won't be too cold, that will make another scorched soul envious. I will drink water at the river's edge and erect a gazebo that will make hungry souls envious. But if you drag me to death in this way, you won't find anywhere to alight in the West. Now he's referring to the Egyptian custom of creating a house for the soul, very, very, very concrete. So he's creating this very concrete idea. If you let me die, before I kill myself, I'll build a nice house for us and we can live in this nice house together. It's a very objectified vision of the afterlife and a very external kind of trying to compel and demand that his soul does as he wants. Be patient, my soul, my brother, until an heir exists who will make offering, who will attend the tomb of the day of burial and transport the bier to the necropolis. So this is now the carrot, the stick of, you know, nobody will attend to you. So then we get the response of the soul again. If you think about burial, it is heartbreaking, tearful, miserable. It's like taking a man away from his home and casting him upon the high ground. You'll not go out again and see the sun. Those who built in granite achieved works, beautiful pyramids, beautiful works, so that their builders should become gods. yet their altars have been destroyed. Like the lost souls who perished on the shore for want of an heir. When the waves have taken their toll, and the sunlight likewise, to whom only the fish at the water's edge speak, listen to me. Look, it's good to listen to people. Be happy and forget all cares. There's another terrible kind of bland answer. You know, as you can imagine the guy at the other end. But, you know, and in a way this is certainly my own experience of consulting the depths in myself. You know, one of the real kind of signs of when you're touching something that's deep is you normally do not like the answer because it's not contained within your own known. You know, it kind of drives you a bit crazy. The soul then continues then by giving him two parallels, which he also loves, to try and hammer home to him what's he trying to say here. So what he does, what the soul does then is something interesting. He shifts into images. So we have these rather bland, infuriating kind of answers that are just sort of blocking answers. But then the soul gives two images. And it's the first image, first parable. A commoner ploughs his plot. He loads his harvest into a boat. He tows it along, for his feast day draws near. He has seen the darkness of a north wind coming on. He keeps watch in the boat as the sun sets. Then he gets out with his wife and children, and they perish by a pool, encircled at night by crocodiles. He ends by sitting down and crying out, I do not weep for that one who is born, he means his wife, although for her there is no leaving of the West to be on earth again, but I think about her children, broken in the egg, who saw the face of the crocodile before they had lived. It's a very powerful kind of image. So he's giving us this image of the thing to be really concerned about. I mean, it's awful here, the wife has died. But the real tragedy is those, the children broken in the egg, who see the face of death before they live. That's a powerful kind of mysterious image, because I mean, what's been given here is this image of, you know, setting out, going off to in the morning, and in a way it's a kind of condensed version of some of the images you find in the Netherworld books. You start in the morning and you have your harvest, you're going to a feast day, you're setting out on the journey of life, and then at sunset there's something, some trouble comes, this wind, the black wind comes, and you come to a pool of crocodiles, and death happens. But the thing to be really mourned are those who are in the egg, who meet death before they have lived. There's a lot in that. He then gives another image, which is much more homely kind of image, but has its own power. A commoner asks for his meal. His wife says to him, wait till supper. He goes outside and urinates in anger. When he turns back to the house, he is like another man. He will not speak. His wife pleads with him, but he does not listen to her. He is offended and unyielding to the other members of the household. Now here he's talking about the breakdown of relationship and the idea of wanting something before its time. Now partly that's about the man wanting to die before his time, but it's that again, it's that image of I want it now, and that kind of and if I can't get it now, there is this kind of almost cataclysmic breaking of relationship. The household in the actual Egyptian, the image of unyielding to the other members of the household, this sense of the household being completely destroyed because there is no dialogue, no communication. Now the man, having received these images, then kind of then starts to dialogue more powerfully, much more deeply with the soul. I opened my mouth to my soul to answer what he had said. Look, he says, my name stinks. Now the name in Egyptian tradition is not just even reputation, it would be your energy or your whole field of expression. My name stinks more than the smell of carrion on summer days when the sky is hot. My name stinks more than a catch of eels on a catch day when the sky is hot. My name stinks more than the smell of birds. So there's real self-hatred, real disgust, really turning inward in rage now. More than the smell of birds, more than the covert of reeds full of waterfowl. My name stinks more than the smell of fishermen, more than the creaks of the marshes they've fished, more even than the smell of crocodiles, more than sitting under a bank of crocodiles. My name stinks more than a married woman about whom salacious lies are told. My name stinks more than a healthy child about whom it is said he belongs to somebody who hates him. My name stinks more than a noble of the sovereign that utters sedition behind his back. Now he's on a bit of a roll now at this point. And anyway, to whom can I talk today? Brothers are bowed. Today's friends do not care. Minds are greedy. Every man steals his fellow's belongings. To whom can I talk today? Mercy has perished. Sternness has descended upon everyone. To whom can I talk today? There is contentment with badness. Goodness is cast aside everywhere. To whom can I talk today? He who should enrage another with his bad deed makes everybody laugh with his evil crime. Who does that remind us of? To whom can I talk today? Plunder is rife. Every man robs his fellow. To whom can I talk today? The wrongdoer is a friend. The close brother has become an enemy. To whom can I talk today? Yesterday is not remembered. No one helps him who gave help them. To whom can I talk today? Brothers are bad. To whom can I talk today? I am weighed down with misery for want of a friend. To whom can I talk today? Wrongdoing afflicts the land. There is no end to it. And this repeated refrain, to whom can I talk today? There's an obvious figure he can talk to you, which is his soul, but he's not that. And it really represents that place, very powerful place, really, where you're going round and round inside yourself, and everything feels impossible, everything feels terrible. And then we're left in the poem. It's that question that hangs in the air: to whom can I talk today? And of course, the figure that is there, that is listening, to whom he is actually talking, is the soul. But of course, he's not focusing on that. He's focusing on there is no, there's nothing. You can feel this kind of introverted kind of rage somewhere. And then what starts to happen, this is what they call the third litany. And this is it. This is just interesting, because there's a sort of shift that starts to happen here. Death is in my sight today, like the recovery of a sick man, like going outside after detention. Death is in my sight today, like the smell of myrrh, like sitting under an awning on a breezy day. Death is in my sight today, like the smell of lotus blossoms, like sitting on the shore of drunkenness, like a well-watered path, like a man coming home from an expedition. Death is in my sight today, like the sky is clearing, like the man grasping what he did not know before. Death is in my sight today, like a man's longing to see a home after spending many years in captivity. So that the images now are actually kind of quite beautiful. So there is a movement out of that kind of repetitive kind of rage, and even out of, and even a different kind of quality from that place where I just want it all to be over. There's a sense of being with death, being with that sense of radical change, but the images have a more beautiful, more kind of releasing kind of quality. And he goes on there, surely he who is there, he who is in the place of death, will be a living God, punishing the deed of the wrongdoer. Surely he who is there will stand in the bark. This is a ship of the sun. This is a reference into this descent of the sonship into the depths. Surely he who is there will be a wise man who, when he speaks, cannot be prevented from appealing to Ra, the sun god, the god who is the kind of creator god. So there's suddenly, as he starts to find a different relationship to death, he's starting to see the death not just now as a release from something and as sort of you just get away from everything. There's a sense of sort of blessedness, a sense of a different way to be. And is this moment, the soul absolutely takes its moment. Is it in that this final bit of this poem, when the soul comes rushing in, having, in a way, noticed the shift of his attention, the shift of possibility, which is away from the sort of, I want to die because I want to get away from everything, and away from the everything is terrible and I hate everybody and everything, including myself. Suddenly there's a sort of possibility of openness. My soul said to me, throw lamentations over the fence, my partner, my brother. May you make offerings upon the brazier and fight for life, as you have said. Love me here and now, having set aside the West, having set aside the land of death, but still long to reach the West. When your body is laid in earth, I will alight when you are weary, and we will reach harbour together. So it is from start to finish. Now this final piece, really, of the poem, is a place where of opposites coming together. It is the place that you find in the Book of Gates of the empty scales, where something has got released, and there is a communion. There is a, because what the soul says to the man is to long for the West here and now, but set aside the desire to die, long to die, but long to die here in the midst of your life. And the image that is given about your body coming to earth, it could be an image, it can be an image of death, but it can also be an image of relaxing into the body, relaxing into the ground. So that the soul, and you get this then sort of fusion in a sense between the human being and the soul, that are in dialogue together, that reach a peaceful kind of place together. But the whole, in a way, process that has to, and if we come back to that image of the Book of Gates, this is told here as one linear kind of process. What we have to imagine, what is being spelled out for us in the poem and in the Egyptian text, is a process of repetition, where you move round and round through these experiences, through the place of having had enough, wanting to die, and raging, then starting to feel, experience these images that have more peace and life in it, and then coming into a place of communion. And then losing it again, and then beginning the process over and over again, but gradually inching forward. Now the thing that I like about that little poem, really, in a way, that it condenses much of the material you find in fact the much more complicated but imageful books of the netherworld. But it also really speaks. It spoke to me in this place of kind of inner and outer despair, which in some ways is a sane reaction to the world. You know, I don't think, we can think of despair as a, and of course despair can kill, but despair can also be a sense that you're in touch with reality. If you look at what's happening in Syria, you look at what's happening in the environment, it is good and right to feel despair. It's not good and right to be destroyed by despair. But that place of the place of the beginning, the place of I want to get away from all this, the place of kind of trying to somehow, it is such a powerful poem, really, because there's the way of trying to threaten and cajole your way out of something, and then raging, and then kind of hating yourself, hating the world, that then exhausts itself and enables new possibilities. Now, the key thing, above all, is to continue the dialogue, to continue the inner process. Now that's that image of the repeating spiral and the descent that later becomes an ascent. The sense of separation you find at the beginning of the poem that then comes into this finding harbour together, entering into the body, entering into the earth, entering into this place of communion. Now that's the sort of, in a way, the Egyptian answer, I suppose. So out of 4,000 years ago, this is a sort of an answer that says, look, these are ways that other people at other times have found to engage with these energies. You know, I find them strangely kind of contemporary, really. I mean, there's something a bit kind of helpful about coming, in all the things we're facing today, reading that poem and thinking, well, I recognize that feeling, yeah, that's absolutely how it feels. And then this turn that happens, a turn where the kind of the sense of a death that isn't running away, a death that actually has these mischievous kind of images that lead on to a sense of communion with the depth. And in a way, I think what all this material does for me is give me kind of icons that I can reach towards. So in the times when I'm feeling really kind of despairing and kind of and just want to end it all, that image of the children who die in the egg, who feel a crocodile before they live, reminds me of the kind of, if you like, the kind of the energies that my own children, the children within me in that sense, the images that need to live. The energy that moves, in a way, that's the energy that sometimes just gets you up in the morning, that gets you moving through the day, doing something, finding the creativity, the life even within death. You know, that image, that powerful image of the pool, you know, it's a sad image. The man has lost his wife. But the thing that is the worst tragedy than losing a wife for that is losing the children who die before they have lived. And in a way, you know, when we lose somebody that we love, that place of, there's this strange, terrible, annihilating feeling where you do not want to live, yet something in you wants to live, whether you like it or not. And in a way, it's those children who, within you, that want to live, who do not want to die, do not want to face the crocodile before they have lived. It's that shameless capacity of life to keep on living, which, if cooperated with, then starts to take even the images of death and find beauty in them, find possibility in them, and then takes us into this deep kind of communion where there is a sense of peace. Okay, that's enough, I think, really. So thank you very much for listening to me. We'll have a break for half an hour. Thank you. John did want me to say that he's here during the coffee break, but he's not going to be here at the end. They're packing up and going away. So if you've got your eyes on some of his books, that you know that this is the moment. Just while we're thinking of books, before we go, he's got a couple of books there. If you're interested in the Egyptian thing, there's a wonderful thing called Writings from Ancient Egypt, which is it's a penguin. It's got the poem I've just recited in it. It's got lots of other really interesting things. You might want to look at that. He's also got, there's a really interesting copy of really interesting book called The Sun God's Journey Through the Netherworld, which is a Jungian analysis of one of the Netherworld books. And he's got one copy of that there, so if you're interested in it. Anyway, enough for now. Thank you very much.